Be the right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything different?
All right, we're going to get to our interview with Lucas Glover here very shortly. I would imagine that a group of you are tuning in to hear about Lucas's recent run-in with his wife in Ponte Vedra. It's been all over the news, and it's no secret to anybody in the golf world. I want to set the scene first that Lucas and I had agreed prior to the Players to do this interview during Memorial Tournament Week. Obviously, this incident popped up in the meantime, and Lucas was kind enough to honor this podcast request, and it was kind of still his idea to follow through and go through with the podcast. So I did, of course, ask him how he wanted to handle the recent incident in terms of the podcast, and he said that he cannot say anything about it. I'm welcome to ask about it, but his response is going to be that I literally can't say anything about it. So there is no discussion about it on the podcast, and that it was Lucas's request. And obviously we are understanding of the position that he's in, and that if he could say anything about it, he would. He's looking forward to being able to speak about it into the near future, but there is no conversation about it on the podcast. I hope that's understandable, and we sincerely appreciate Lucas's willingness to go forward with the podcast during this difficult time for him and his family. So with that in mind, we get right into it. No formalities, no introduction. We start talking about the Memorial Tournament and, of course, his career on the PGA Tour. So hope you enjoy it, and I hope you respect Lucas's privacy in this time related to the incident and understand the situation that he's in. And really appreciative of the content that we got out of this, and hope you guys enjoy. Cheers. So growing up here as a kid, I got to attend the Memorial Tournament. I didn't know how special of a tournament it was growing up here as a kid. What makes the Memorial special to someone like you?
It's Jack's place, first and foremost. And the history here, the conditions of the golf course, and just the best field, one of the best fields of the year, and one of the best courses of the year, one of the best weeks of the year. Great for family, great for friends, and great for the fans. It's always right here, Memorial, around the Memorial holiday, either the week of or the week leading to. So fan support's great. Columbus golf history is amazing, and just killer week all the way around.
So from a hospitality standpoint, I feel like other tournaments have started to catch up to Memorial. How many years have you been coming here, and can you see kind of the influence this event has had from a hospitality standpoint for the players at other events?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is 15 years on tour. First 2 years, I wasn't in, didn't finish high enough to qualify myself, but since then I haven't missed it. And hospitality-wise, as far as, you know, you drive up, they valet, they take your car, locker rooms top shelf, food at in the locker room's amazing. You can eat dinner here. It's one of the, I think we only got three events now you can eat dinner at the clubhouse,
really?
Which is awesome. And yeah, this was a, I think this was a model for a lot of tournaments, and they've started catching up, but they got it nailed here for sure.
From a golf course standpoint, what here suits your eye, what doesn't? Is this a good course fit for you?
Yeah, I like it. I've always liked it. There's a lot of shape shots. You know, I kid Mr. Nicklaus when I see him that a lot of them are fades, but, you know, being a hooker, give him a hard time about that. But I thank everybody at Bay Hill for the right to left. But no, it's great. It's got a lot of courses, if that makes sense. It's got trees in play like a Hilton Head or a Colonial. It's got short holes. It's got long holes. It's got reachable par fives, and they're so Nicklaus perfect risk reward, which he's known for par fives. And they're the best set of par fives risk reward I've ever played. And if you're driving it good, long irons or fairway wooding it good, you can make a ton of birdies on the fives. If you're not, the layups are tough, the wedge shots are tough, etc. And typical of a Nicklaus, the par threes are amazingly good / difficult.
The back nine ones, first of all, are like perfect replicas of 12 and 16 of Augusta, almost perfect,
right?
But just more difficult,
right?
And that 16th green still doesn't hold balls,
no,
as well as the other holes.
No,
do.
Won't hold a javelin, we like to say.
All right, this question I've always wanted to ask you this because it drives me absolutely insane. How do you hit a golf club, a golf ball, without wearing a glove? I don't understand it.
Yeah, my hands don't sweat for whatever reason. It's got to be crazy humid to just get a little bit, but I didn't grow up using one. My first instructor, or my first real instructor as a kid, was Dick Harmon. And I remember the first or second time I went to Houston to visit with him, my grandfather went with me, and I hit so many balls, my hands started to hurt, so they – Old man, tough love, went inside, cut the fingers out of a glove and said, well, at least your palms won't hurt. And that was the last time I wore a glove. I was 12.
You have not worn one that
I've not worn one since.
Even when it rains, you don't need a glove.
Nothing. So
if I get like a bead of sweat on my hands, I put my rain gloves on because I can't. You must have like a really good, just strong grip on the club.
I may grab it a little too tight. But no, a joke my buddies like to play on me is if they want to laugh, they give me a glove and say, here, hit me a 7-iron, and I'm a solid 15 handicap.
Really?
With a glove.
It affects you that much?
Oh yeah, I got no idea where the club head is. No idea. Can't feel the club head, don't know where it is, and it's either a dead block or a rope with a 7-iron.
The irony of the U.S. Open that you won being like the most rain-soaked event ever without the glove just blows my mind. I can't physically. We're going to get to the U.S. Open, but
sure.
You touched on it there with Dick Harmon. But what was your upbringing like in golf? How did you get into golf, and what was your young golf career like?
Yeah, grandfather was an athlete, baseball, football growing up. Took up golf when he got into business after his sports career was over. Just fell in love with it and ended up playing a lot of, I guess they'd call it customer golf for entertainment, and turned himself into a pretty good player. And then my mom has 5 brothers, and when I was growing up, I think their combined handicap was around 10. So a lot of good holiday golf with the fam. And so did the whole family thing, started playing tournaments around 7 or 8, and full-fledged junior schedule at 10. And Jay Haas, who lived in my hometown and was a member at the course we were members at, my grandfather went to Jay and said, he's passing me, I can't keep up, I don't know what to tell him anymore. And Jay said, well we got, you know, right now you got 2 options if you want to go take him to see the best and see if he can improve and maybe take this thing where y'all think he can. You can go see David Ledbetter or Dick Harmon. And our plan was to see both, and we saw Dick first, and no offense to David, but I didn't feel, and my grandfather didn't feel at that time, we needed to go see David. It was just a really, really good fit with Dick and the way he was with me. And so I worked with him all through high school, all through college, and until the day he died in 2006. But high school was typical high school golf, and summer schedule, a couple tournaments here and there, and then college at Clemson. And
what was the course you grew up playing? Sorry,
Thornblade.
It's Thornblade. That's what I thought.
Yep, where you just were. My grandmother probably watched you hit a few shots on 17 there. She's to the left of 17 okay. tee, still there. But and then college at Clemson, and had a solid career there, and decided, I don't know, about halfway through that, I wanted to really go full force and try to get out here.
Yeah, well, you're breezing through it rather quickly. So high school, no, it's all good. High school golf, you won states as a freshman and sophomore. Is that when did you know that you were like a special talent at golf, and not just better than your closest peers, but you had a special talent?
It was interesting. Early on, I was a big kid, so I hit it further than everybody from, you know, 8 years old to 12 or 13. And because of that, I seem to do very well because, you know, obviously you hit it further, you have shorter clubs in, and it's easier. Well, as everybody caught up to me in size and then therefore in length, it became harder for me. And the complacency might have caught up a little bit early in high school. Some guys I was beating a lot started beating me, and that really opened my eyes. All right, we got to change the way we work at this. And my grandfather and my parents were very instrumental in that. And he said, look, if you want to do this, we kind of got to – we're not pushing you, we're not telling you have to do things, but there needs to be a little more dedication because we spend a lot of money traveling and this and that, and let's, you know, if you want to do this, let's get what we can out of it. And that resonated, but only when some guys I was used to beating started beating me a good bit and more than I was beating them. So that turned it around. So probably sophomore, junior year of high school, I knew I wanted to play in college, and then I knew I kind of wanted to do it, but I didn't really know if it was realistic yet. I thought I needed to see what happened in college And
There, did you think you would be an elite player there, or did you think you'd fit in with the rest of the team, or where did you think you racked up at that point?
I knew I'd fit in with the guys because I'd been over there a fair amount. I grew up only 40 minutes from Clemson and spent, you know, a lot of time there going to football games and sporting events and a lot of family history there. And so I visited there a lot, knew some of the guys that were a little older than me when I was a junior, and so I knew we'd get along. And but I didn't know if it would translate. I didn't know if I expected it to, but in the back of my mind, I was like, you know, they're not giving me a spot in the starting five. I still got to go earn it. And you got the defending NC2A individual champion, Charles Warren, who was there his senior year, my freshman year, two other seniors that had played almost every event, and another freshman coming in with me, and Jonathan Bird was going to be a sophomore. So there was no guarantees. You know, it turned out good, but all those guys made me better. The competition made me better. The silly gambling games at practice made me better, and all that stuff. But we were pretty well loaded for 4 years, and the competing for national championships as a team and individually and all that stuff was pretty good prep. And I kind of saw it. I thought I had a pretty good chance, but it was still motivating. My first couple years weren't great. I played okay, but my last 2 years were pretty good, and I felt like if I kept on the right track, I could get out here and maybe make some noise.
So you won three events while you were at Clemson. You won the South Carolina AM three times, and then played on the 2001 Walker Cup team. Was that so? You talked a bit about kind of seeing where your game racked up as you moved up the ladder. What was the Walker Cup like? Was that another chance to kind of play against people from another country and see where you stood?
Absolutely.
That was a pretty stacked Walker Cup when it comes to pros that ended up playing at the elite level.
Yeah,
we got
worked, but that was special. I played on the Palmer Cup in college, and that was so special. That was the first opportunity I had to carry the red, white, and blue on my back, and that was really cool. And I think that and the Walker Cup kind of formed my affinity for team golf and my respect for it and want to, and you know, still a huge goal to play on a Ryder Cup. But yeah, Walker Cup with the team we had, the team they had, it was going to be a test, and it was going to be a good barometer for where I stood, because a few of their guys played over here. Luke Donald, gosh, I'm blanking.
Graham McDowell.
Graham. Nick Doherty, I knew of him. He didn't go to school over here, but I knew of him. And, they were loaded. But, you know, we as a team didn't put up a very good fight, but I felt like I played pretty well. I do remember being three under through four against Luke individual and being three down. So yeah.
What?
Yeah.
How is that possible?
I think he birdied – or two down, I'm sorry. Okay. He birdied three holes and made an eagle. All right. Cool, man.
Wake-up call.
Yeah, exactly.
So around this time you're about to start your transition to professional golf, who were the guys you looked up to the most on the PGA Tour? Who, if you would have walked into the same room as, would you have been starstruck by?
Obviously Tiger.
It's 2001. I mean,
yeah,
it's right 2000, about that time.
2001, 2002, he's tip top, right? But I mean, he had already taken the world by storm, but he was winning everything by a lot. And you know, he had the best swing in the world maybe in history right around then. And did for a long time. I'm never gonna say anything about Tiger's golf swing. I'm still in awe of it and the things he can do. That being said, I was always very impressed and have a great relationship still with Jay Haas. I grew up in the same town he lived in and raised his family in, and I looked up to Jay since I was a kid, and doing that and then getting advice from him, getting some push from him, getting some tips from him, and even still I walk in a room and it's still like, man, there's Jay, how cool. But but Tiger was the one at the time. Everybody was starstruck and bright-eyed by him, and we all should have been. But it was still a few years before I'd see him in person. So,
if you could go back to Lucas Glover in 2001, 2002, and give that person any advice, what would it be? What's something that you were just completely ignorant to about life on PGA Tour or anything like that?
It's hard. It's not wake up, roll out of bed, go to the tee. there's and I talk about this a lot with juniors or Q&As or different things we do, is it's the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday grind to get ready for Thursday was so different than I expected. Traveling, playing nationwide tour then, and then transitioning to out here, and then transitioning to traveling with a family, and just the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday grind of tour life, no matter what tour it is, was a surprise to me. I knew it wasn't easy. I knew traveling was not easy on the body, easy on the game, this and that. I didn't realize, and maybe till even my late 20s, how tough it was.
Especially back-to-back weeks,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Or three in a row.
Yeah, two, three, four weeks in a row, or you're not playing well and you're trying to play your way out of it, and you feel like every day you need to be grinding when it might be better to take a day off, and then learning which one's better for you or not, or et cetera, et cetera. But, and all that's a personal thing too. You got to know your body, know what you need, know what you don't. But I was, your original question, go back, what would you tell yourself? You gotta be diligent with your time early in the week and make travel day. Don't try to cram too much in. All right, I got to get there at noon on Monday so I can practice all day. And let's make Monday a travel day and just build in a day off every week. Mm-hmm. A lot of times early in my career, I was trying to bust out of town Sunday, get in at midnight to the next town, and get out there Monday at 9 a.m. and work, and then play Tuesday and then practice all day Wednesday. Come Thursday, I was kind of tired.
Yeah.
Like, man, but I think that's also being excited about being new on tour and excited about competing and excited about trying to beat the guys you looked up to all your life. But that is a trap, I think. And I see it now with some guys that I play some practice rounds with that are just new out here, and they're so excited to go to the next place the next week. And I say, hey man, let's kind of
deep breaths,
yeah,
take it slow.
Well, yeah, let's kind of walk in instead of running in this mm-hmm. week. And
but even established professionals, and you're probably still experiencing it. That, I mean, Rory talked about getting to tournaments earlier this year and having kind of a new schedule when he gets to tournaments and preparation wise. So people are always kind of tinkering with that schedule, even after you've established, quote unquote, established yourself. There's different routines that you try, and I think Phil has tried every different way of preparing for the U.S. Open and for the Masters, and everyone's got their own different cycles.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of it depends. Are you in the Pro-Am every week? So do I get in Tuesday night at an event I've played the last 10 years, or do I get in Monday night, play nine holes Tuesday, and then practice? What? And again, it's a personal thing. And as you are more established, chances are you're having a family, or you got family obligations. So do I slide home for a Monday, Tuesday morning, and then get back out, and the next week may be different. So it's all reading your body, knowing what you need. Especially I'm 38, 15th season out here, and I'm still learning and doing things and having to talk myself into a day off or talk myself into a grind. Or you just got to listen to your body and listen to your mind too. You got to rest your brain out here too, as weird as that sounds.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. Yep. A quick update from our friends at Callaway as they continue to bring the heat with the new black Smoke Roke Pro irons. These murdered out pros are some of the coolest irons I've ever seen. The iron heads feature a sleek black PVD finish with a custom black medallion, and they come stock with a limited edition blacked out True Temper XP 105 shaft and a black grip. Rogue is the number one selling iron in the U.S. this year, thanks to the combination of Callaway's new urethane microspheres for soft feel and great sound, and 360 face cup for incredible ball speed, even on off-center hits. The Rogue Pro Black Irons will be available for a limited time starting next Friday, June 8th. Visit CallawayGolf.com for more info on Rogue Pro Black Irons from Callaway, the number one irons in golf. I swear they keep putting me in a new set of irons that I love, and they keep coming out with even better ones that make me want to try even more. I need to just settle in on one, but they keep making this more difficult. So back to Lucas Glover. So going from Clemson straight to the nationwide tour, you didn't earn your card in the first year, but you broke out in 2003, you won on the nationwide tour, earned your card. What did that nationwide tour kind of teach you about professional golf? I'd imagine one of the first things is it's not all glitz and glamour.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah, I did the mini tour stuff kind of into 01 and 02. Played, I don't know, four or five different tours all around 02. But I Mondayed enough into some nationwide events and had enough top 25s. And I ended up with probably a half of a schedule that year. And I finished high enough to get status the next year. missed my cut by a shot in 02. And I say it, I've said it 100 times, that's the best thing that happened to me as a pro, yeah. was not getting my card in 02 because I was not ready. I lipped out a chip on 9 at stadium course in PGA West to get my card and was completely devastated. But 2, 3, 4 years later, 15 years later now, it's the best thing that happened to me. Yeah. I was not ready to be out here. And to your point, that showed me that, all right, now I'm on a tour for the whole year. I can pick my schedule and start learning how to play golf week in and week out, different courses, different
grasses,
different cities, different grass, and adapting to adversity, you know, adapting to not having your game but grinding out a cut when you need it because you're trying to get your card. So are 150 other guys out there. And but that year, 03, having that schedule planned and laid out and just learning – tour life with a schedule, with a plan, was huge. And I think it, you know, won kind of 3/4 of the way through the year to ice down my card after playing pretty solid for the year. So
that's what almost everyone I talk to about their time, you know, the established tour pros talk about their time on Nationwide Tour, you know, web.com tour, whatever it is, they almost all kind of say that same thing. And like, that taught me how to be a professional. Like,
absolutely.
I needed that. If you go straight out to the PGA Tour, you're just not ready to handle that grind. So yeah.
It's remarkable what a lot of the young kids that are out here winning are doing without experiencing that.
Yeah.
It shows you how good that young crop really is.
And that's what you know, you go out into web events and you see such a eclectic mix of journeymen and young guys and guys in their 30s that are still trying to make it, and it just gives you that much more appreciation for the guys that are able to retain their card year in and year out. So your rookie season on the PGA Tour was 2004. You finished outside the top 125. You regained your card at Q School. But what do you remember most about that year? Was there still kind of that shock factor when you got out there for the first time?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I played in a couple of events on some sponsor exemptions because of some things we talked about earlier, Walker Cup, and pretty decent college career, and qualified for the U.S. Open in 02 at Bethpage. That was my first major. And so when I got my full tour card in 04, there was still a little bit, oh man, I'm on tour full time, I gotta do this, but there was also a little sense of comfort because I'd played in a handful of events leading up to that season. But I remember my first event, full event, was Sony in Hawaii, and I played on Sunday early. I barely made the cut. I played Sunday early with Lauren Roberts. And Lauren Roberts hit about 6 greens and shot a couple under, and I think I hit 15 or 16 and shot a couple over. And I remember walking back over to the hotel thinking, man, I probably should go chip and putt a little because that guy's been out here a really long time, and it didn't look like he should have beat me today. But one of those learning experiences from those established guys, you learn, said, you know, he didn't have it. He just grinded out a 67 or 8, whatever it was, hitting 6 greens, getting up and down, and might have hit 6 fairways, whatever it was. But that season was great. It was, again, a lot of learning, and missed my card. Went back to Q School, birdied 3 of the last 4 to get my card back, even though I had a little security, that 126 to 150. But you always want that. You always want that full exempt status for scheduling. But that was kind of a blessing also in disguise, that you get out there, it's not guaranteed. You gotta work, you gotta grind.
So what have you always been known essentially as a ball striker? Like when you came out on tour, you were a ball striker. That first year, I know you just referenced that story, but did you know your putting and chipping needed to improve drastically, or did you have any kind of grasp as to where your strengths were and where your weaknesses were?
Yeah, always been a good ball striker, always been a good ball hitter, and always, you know, was comfortable curving the ball and trying to shape it, and predominantly a hooker, but don't mind cutting it if I have to. But that was kind of bread and butter. That's always in my back pocket, or especially then. But, you know, short game, day in and day out here, it's the most important thing. And I can't tell people that enough. And it's hard to understand when all they show is us hitting drivers and tapping in for birdie on par fives. You know, I feel like that's all we see anymore. But I didn't know at the time that it needed that much work, because it was solid, but it wasn't great. But days like that, and then seeing how tour players that had been out here a long time practiced and prepared their short games for the week at different places and different shots they may need at different courses was eye-opening. A good experience and a good learning experience.
It's interesting to hear you say that short game being the most important, because the statistics that have come out in recent years, I'm not sure how familiar you are with Mark Brody and the strokes gain analysis. I was just blown away at how much emphasis he thinks there is on tee to green and how that makes up essentially 70% of the game, whereas the remaining 30% is putting. Have you looked into statistic analysis or done any research regarding that? Has that helped you at all with any parts of your game?
I do look at it to see, weekly, where did I stack up? My instructor, Tony Ruggiero, sends me a little info packet every Sunday night after a tournament. Here's where you stacked up against the top 10. Here's where you stacked up against the winner. And then obviously the tour stats are easy. You can just go on there and
sure.
Look. But it is a great thing, great barometer to see, all right, where did I stack up against everybody that played better than me, or what did I do well or not so well that week according to the whole field instead of just the 10 or the top 10 or the winner. And frankly, for me, it's usually in that putting short game area. So I didn't know about the 70% that the tee to green. So that good for me, man.
Well, that's the biggest takeaway I had from that was I kept blaming myself for missing like 10-foot par putts, and I said if I could just putt, I would be such a good player. And then you look at the end of the day, I'm like, oh, I hit 8 greens today. Like I shouldn't probably shoot under par. And it was so much emphasis gets put on whether or not you hit the ball into the hole, but you don't factor in the variance of the likelihood of that you'd actually make that putt.
Right. So what blew me away, and this has been a few years now, but I was very irritated at myself about like 6 to 8 foot putts. I was pretty good from short, doing pretty good 10 to 20 feet in these little 6-8 footers. And somebody, I think it was another player, I can't remember who, he said, you know what, don't be so hard on yourself. Tour average from there is like 61% or something. So how many are you making? I was like, you know, I feel like I make 2 out of 3. And they go, that's better than tour average, bro. I was like, oh. You never really think about it because you think you should make every 6-footer, 8-footer. And then you think about it, you're like, maybe I should lighten up on that a little bit. So to your point, you know, don't be so hard on yourself about 10-footers.
You're already going to get the podcast bump this week. So now that I'm giving you tips here.
Yeah, I know you're giving me all the stuff.
No, but the more I look at it, the more, and that's why I was especially interested to talk to you, that I think so much of this game is about getting the ball close to the hole in 2 shots and on par threes in 1 shot.
Sure.
And that so much gets decided, and how I'm with my own personal game, I'm trying to miss on fat side of greens much more than get after pins, because the amount of shots I cost myself by missing in the bunkers or short side of myself is way – I lose more shots than I do making birdies at those pins. It's a different game for you guys, obviously.
Well, think about it this way. When your short game's, you know, really good, let's take Jordan. When Jordan's clicking on all cylinders, short sighting doesn't scare him. Short sighting doesn't scare Phil. Short sighting doesn't scare Tiger.
Yeah.
Because, all right, I'm gonna pick my spots, but if I do pick a spot and miss on the short side, my short game's good enough right now, or I'm making all my putts if I hit a decent to average chip or bunker shot or whatever. So that frees up your mind a little too. And I, from my own experience, I feel that way when I feel like my short game and the putter's good, and that's just that confidence of having, you know, again, short game good, short game in your back pocket and bail you out of some trouble.
Yeah.
And so anyway, that's here nor there, I guess.
All right, so 2005, your first victory on tour, you win at Disney. What do you remember most about your first PGA Tour win?
That crazy bunker shot.
Yeah.
Like 38 yards or something, 38, 35 yards. And I remember, obviously, that coming from kind of nowhere. I shot, I don't know, 31 or 2 on the back. But I remember waiting on a playoff. Like, I remember standing over there on the range, Magnolia course at Disney, and I think Tom Pernice was the only one that could tie me. And coming up 18, and I just remember standing there, and I think Slugger was there. And he's just, you know, he's, like, cool and calm, and I'm, you know, I could –
panic.
Yeah, I'm full panic. What do I do if he makes that 10-footer or 12-footer, whatever Tom had? And so I got to go back to 18. All right, leave me the driver. I got to hit some kind of draw out there, and then it's probably like an 8-iron. I didn't even think about.
Things are moving quickly.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, I remember the bunker shot, and I remember my little goofy reaction, like, did that actually happen? And then I really just remember standing over there on the range in full panic, like, oh my, if he makes that, what do we do now? Oh yeah, we got to go play. And again, it was just, you said it perfectly, things are moving quick, things are moving fast, and he was playing really, really slow, it felt like. He wasn't, but to me, things were moving fast.
So, and then 2006, and I don't remember exactly what kind of where you stood, but you had 9 top tens, and it seemed like you had one of your better years on tour. Were you in the running for a captain's pick for the Ryder Cup at that point? Do you remember how close you were?
I was. 6 and 8, definitely. I'm trying to remember. I get the years confused who was captain when, but
6 was – 8 was Zinger,
yep.
But 6 was Tom Lehman, I think.
Okay, yeah, definitely was in the running there. Played practice rounds with Tom at TPC, and he was kind of feeling me out. And I believe he ended up picking Scott Verplank and Stewart. Still to this day, two of my better friends, and were two of my better friends on the tour then. So no hard feelings there, but – 9 top tens and a win the year before, and I felt like I deserved it. I think they picked a lot earlier then, and if I remember right, they picked Monday or Tuesday of Akron, and then I finished 4th in Akron that week. So.
And you finished tied for 8th at the Tour Championship too,
right
before
so,
it.
So my memory's not as bad as I think, but I did feel deserving then, but I also understood Tom's reasoning was I got a bunch of rookies and I need some veterans. I said, hey man, I get it.
Yep.
And he told me then who he was picking. I said, you know what, those are my buddies, good for them. And you know, I was happy for them, sad for myself, but you know, life goes on, and I still played pretty good golf that year.
Next year you get a captain's pick from Jack Nicklaus for the President's Cup.
Yep.
First team golf, you mentioned how much you enjoyed it.
Yeah.
So what was that? That had to feel like quite the honor.
Yeah, that was amazing. That was amazing. And I had a pretty good feeling that it was going to happen. I'd seen Slew a bunch, Jeff Sluman, who was the assistant captain, and Jeff did a great job of sticking around everybody and staying in touch. And I remember walking through the airport the night they were picking, and phone rang, and I don't even know if I knew what caller ID was, but I knew I didn't have it programmed in my phone. And I said, well, that's an odd number. So maybe I should answer this one on a night like this. And it was Mr. Nicklaus. And I knew right then when he said, Lucas, Jack Nicklaus. And it was just the couldn't say it just then or make any emotion about it, but I was elated and relieved too, because it was something I'd focused on and grinded about and kind of stayed up a little at night thinking about it, because I wanted it. I wanted to have that feeling from 01 Walker Cup with the red, white, and blue on your back. That's a pretty good feeling.
Yeah. And so what was the President's Cup experience, right? As you mentioned, for Plank and Sink being some of your buddies, you paired with them for the first 3 rounds, and you played with Charles Howell as well. What do you remember most about the President's Cup?
Just the experience. It was some of my first outside of the ropes experiences with some guys, Tiger, Phil. I'd played with both of them before. I played with Tiger in Flint that year when he won his 50th tour event on Sunday. That was really cool. But my first real experience with a lot of the top echelon guys off the golf course. And that was really cool for me, being pretty young, seeing how they operate, seeing what they do, seeing what they don't do, seeing how they react in the team room. Because at the time, I wanted to be on those teams every year. And
sure.
At some point, like now, being 38, I wanted to have been one of those mainstays. It didn't turn out that way, but that's okay. That's golf. But I wanted to see if I did continue to have success, and how they treated people and how they treated everybody in those team events. And it was amazing. It was an amazing experience, and makes you want to get back on those teams, because it's truly fun.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun.
That's what everyone talks about,
yeah.
How much fun they have.
It's so much fun.
Team room. Did you feel like you belonged in that room, or did you feel like you're walking on eggshells being a rookie around some of those guys?
I did at first, but they made sure that I didn't feel that way long, all of them. And I had a pretty good relationship with Slew leading in, because of Jay Davis, a lot of the older guys that Slew was friends with. And so he kind of grabbed me before, and he goes, look, man, we picked you because you deserve it. So let's go play golf.
Yeah.
That's all it is now. And that was great. And I needed to hear that. And I needed to feel that acceptance to get to Thursday. You know, you don't want to feel like you're walking on eggshells, but
right.
Everybody was accepting, and fun. I mean, it was just fun riding the bus, just in the team room, eating. Every meal was team dinner. It was awesome. It was cool.
Cool. Am I reading this right, or do I research this right, that you shut it down shortly after the President's Cup in 07 for a while? Did you take a break?
08.
08. Okay, I had the year wrong. So, well, your 08 season was a bit of a setback. Was there anything in particular you were struggling with in that year?
I think I was just burnt out.
Yeah.
I was a little burned out. I played a ton of golf, and fortunately played a ton of good golf, into five. End of 05, 2006, 2007, that push to make the President's Cup. Make the President's Cup after a whale of a year, come out in 08 with real high expectations. And I didn't meet them. And I kept trying to meet them and trying to get better and trying to win again and da-da-da-da-da. And
pressing.
Perfect word, pressing. And I finished FedEx Cup, and I went, that's enough. I was burnt out, tired, and just shut it down, I think. So we ended then, probably end of August, 1st of September. I don't think I touched the club till Thanksgiving, which was a long time at that time for me, you know, 6-7 weeks off. Literally put them in a closet and didn't want to see them. Mm-hmm. And best thing that probably I could have done.
I was going to say.
Yeah, turned out all right.
Hard to argue with what happened next.
Well, looking back on it, you know, if it went the other way, I'd have been the dumbest guy in the world. But, that's just the way things work in life, I guess.
So you had a T3 at the Buick to kick off the season. You tied for second at Quail Hollow. And then you go to Bethpage, your U.S. Open. That week comes around. Did anything feel different about that week going into it?
Yes. Do you have my numbers there from that year?
I don't. Okay. I can.
I either missed the cut here at Memorial or played so bad that I played really early Sunday. I remember being here on Sunday afternoon on the driving range. I didn't go over and play a practice round at the Lakes or Brookside because I played them before in qualifiers. I was playing so bad I just wanted to hit balls, and I found a little something on the range here. Oddly enough, we're here doing this podcast. And it was pretty simple. I was just trying to take the club back a little bit lower going back, and it just got my turn a little fuller, and I started hitting it, you know, solid again and just smashing it. And I shot 63 the next morning at the Lakes. And then all I had to do was hang on at Brookside. I think I shot one under, qualified pretty easily. Had an off week, took the next week off Memphis to get ready. And luckily I'd qualified for 02 Bethpage. So I knew the golf course and knew what to expect, knew what to work on in that week off at home. And I remember my grandfather went with me to practice like he did every day. And I remember I'd always practice in the morning. We'd have lunch and go play a few holes. And we're on the golf course playing, and I'd hit two drivers on every hole, and I'd hit two iron shots, and I'd basically play two balls. And we were driving back home, and he said, looks like you're swinging pretty good. You're going to have a good week. I said, well, why are you saying that now? He goes, well, I was just thinking about those drivers you hit. And he goes, every one of them, I think I could have, as he would say in an old Southern term, I think I could have thrown a blanket over both of them. And I started thinking about it, and I was like, God, you're right. You know, I hadn't driven it this good in a while. So I had really good feelings leading into Bethpage in 09 about my ball striking, and still at the time, and it's true today, and I think it's just my makeup. It's all about how the putter goes. So I figured, all right, make some putts. I'm going to play well because I'm striping it. And I got there and practiced, prepared. The swing thought was still working, ball still drawing. It's like, all right, here we go. Didn't get to play Thursday.
Yeah.
So it was just like, all right, let's kill the momentum.
Did all the practice rounds go as normal? I don't remember that.
Yeah, everything was pretty normal. I think we got some weather maybe Wednesday evening or something, but I was long gone by then. I'm usually a nine-holer early Wednesday in the majors and done. But, I went out there Thursday for an afternoon time and never hit a shot. Didn't even go to the range. And it was just just bizarre week from then on.
Well, you were there in 02. That was the first U.S. Open held at a public course in New York, and I don't know how long. Mm-hmm. And the crowds, I just remember being absolutely insane. The anticipation for that event was huge. What were you anticipating that same kind of crazy atmosphere going into the week?
Yeah. I mean, it was nuts. You know, remember, unfortunately, they were on Sergio for the waggle.
Yeah.
And singing happy birthday to Phil, I guess, and all that stuff. It was nuts. But had that crazy weather there Friday, Saturday. I remember the cut was 10 over because I shot 11, and I was like, 10 over, that was the cut. Oh, my God. I mean, it was hard to even fathom that. But again, it was good to go back there. I obviously played in three or four other U.S. Opens leading up, but knowing what to work on, knowing what to expect with the fans, knowing where to go, knowing where the parking lot is, all that stuff can be tough at a U.S. Open if you've never been to the venue before.
It's overwhelming a little
bit.
Yeah,
overwhelming, and the stands are bigger, and the crowds are bigger, and obviously the difficulty of the test.
Right.
But having been there before was definitely a benefit from knowing what to expect.
So you go off your first round on Friday. How many holes did you play Friday?
Six, something like that. I remember Saturday playing 30 or 31 holes. So I played five or six the first day and doubled the first hole, which was, yeah. And I've said this a lot talking about it. The best thing for me right then and looking back on it after the fact was that it was about 200 yards to the second tee. Instead of walking right over mad, I had a couple hundred yard walk over the road, back a couple hundred yards to talk to myself and say, you know what, big deal. Everybody's going to have some screw-ups. It's the U.S. Open. Let's just refocus and, you know, make some pars, make birdies when we can. Everybody's struggling out here. It's sloppy. It's tough. It's the U.S. Open. If I got to go 20 yards to the tee and seethe, might have been a different story on the next hole.
Yeah.
But as it was, that might have been a break. Maybe not. Maybe it was just something I'm looking for. But I think it was beneficial to have a long walk.
Once you were playing, I don't really remember, was it raining while you were playing?
Not often.
Okay.
Not often. It was...
It would rain so hard that the play was canceled for everybody, essentially.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I think some people played a few holes Thursday, you know, 8 or 9, 10 holes maybe, and then it just came. And then, you know, we never played the ball up. Kudos to the maintenance staff and maybe the USGA being stubborn, but I don't remember a mud ball, oddly enough. But it was a deluge Thursday, I think a little Friday morning, and then it seemed like it just would decide to rain overnight every night. And then, but they maintained, I don't know how they did it, but the course was still pretty perfect. But unlike any other U.S. Open, unless it was like that, where the ball went, it stayed.
Right.
So you either hit a good shot or you didn't. There wasn't any bouncing through a green or bouncing through the rough on a dog leg or any of that. If you hit it there, it's pretty much going to be a foot or 2 feet from where the ball went.
And then in that third round, you hit a rough patch as well. You had, I think, a bogey double, bogey stretch. Is that right? But before that, I mean, I guess, were the soft conditions, did it just kind of give you a green light to attack pins? Did you see that as an advantage for yourself, anything in particular?
Yeah, well, going back to really having confidence in my golf swing and what my golf ball was doing, I think, you know, I remember Tiger talking about it years ago. He felt like he had his hand on his golf ball. You know, when he was really playing well, like he was, and I had that feeling leading into that week, and I still had that feeling that week that I knew which window it was going to come out of, and I knew how to make it turn over 10 yards, and I knew how to make it not turn over 10 yards if it was a right pin.
Yeah.
So, and that it was just working. And but again, that rough patch you referenced, it's still one of those things. Like, all right, everybody's going to have that here. It's hard. You get in this rough. It's wet. It's gangly. It's just hard. And you almost give yourself a pass at a U.S. Open for having a bad hole or two bad holes or a little bad patch of golf because it's just difficult. But again, if I hadn't had that experience there before, if I hadn't had the experience a couple years before, wouldn't have known that. If you know where it's going and you know it's staying, or I'm sorry, if you know where the ball lands is where it's going to stay, you do have green light more often. There's still some spots there you can't really go at, or I didn't feel I could go at. But if I was trying to hit it 20 feet left of the hole to the fat side, like you were talking about you're doing, I did it. And that's U.S. Open golf, too, and major golf. So
you were one back of Ricky Barnes. You paired with him for the final round. Did you play your entire final round on that Monday, or did it start on Sunday?
I played number one on Sunday night.
That's it.
So my first shot Monday morning was second tee.
Okay.
Yep.
And did it feel like you were four clear of third place? Did it feel like a two-horse race, or were you like, this is the U.S. Open, anything can happen?
It did feel like a two-horse race. I misspoke. My first shot Monday morning was my second shot on number two. Ricky and I hit our tee shots on two. Pardon me. It felt like a two-horse race, except for the horses that were like 3 through 10.
Right.
Right? You know, the score-wise, it felt like that. But in the back of my head, and I'm not going to speak for Ricky, but I assume he felt that way too. Again, I don't know. But those names that were behind us, one that was probably going to wear red and black and one that left-handed, you knew they were going to make a run. And you knew something was going to happen. And sure enough, here they came.
Yeah.
I'm standing on 17T looking over at 18, and Phil's up there by the green. I'm thinking, oh my God, he's driven the green. He's gonna chip that in and be tied, you know. But anyway, we again can't speak for Ricky, but I had this feeling that they were, if we didn't hold serve, they were gonna make a run and make it tough on us, and sure enough, they did. As they should have.
Did the fact that the week was extended and had so much weather issues, did that at all help, you think, with the nerves? I mean, did it kind of throw you off your schedule and you had less time to get nervous in any way? Or,
yeah, you know, there wasn't much sleeping on it,
yeah.
You know, because sleep was pretty quick. It was, you know, every day it was home at dark. Grab dinner on the way home and get as much sleep as you could because you're up, you know, whatever it was, 4:30, 5 o'clock, and restart at 7:30, 8 o'clock. And so, yeah, there wasn't much sleeping on it, sleeping on being in the last group of the U.S. Open or sleeping on being in the lead or sleeping on anything. It was boom, 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 and you're back out there again and slopping through it. And so, yeah, that definitely eased it a little bit as far as the nerves and thinking about it a lot.
Would you classify your club choice off the 72nd hole as a layup?
I'll defer to my caddy on that because he had the driver, I think, tucked under his armpit. So we talked about it. We talked about it, actually. I didn't see the tee was up.
Yeah.
I walked up the hill behind 17 green and took the right, and all the fans went, no, you're up here. I went, no, I'm going. No. And I looked up, I was like, whoa. And they were up on number 5 as well. So, I said to Coop, my caddy, 16 years in August, by the way. So he put up with me a long
time. That's amazing.
And I says, well, you know, what's the cover on the bunkers on both sides? He's like 270, 275 on the right. I said, all right, what do you think about driver? He goes, we're hitting 6-iron. I went, we are? He goes, yeah. He goes, you've hit 5-wood from the back tee to the 150. He goes, it's 192 to the 150, 6-iron, 9-iron, let's go. And I looked at the bag, and he had the driver tucked under the bib, under his arm. So, yes, it was a layup, but it was it was because of him.
I was going to – so just ask – I told a couple of our laying up guys about that we were doing this interview, of course, and they said, all right, well, you got to ask about the 6-iron on 18. Yeah. If there's ever a pass to be given, it's on the 72nd hole of the U.S. Open, so not going to give you a hard time about
that. Two 6-irons off of par 4 tees in the U.S. Open final round.
Really?
5 also, yeah. That was more strategy. They put the tees up on 5, big dog leg left down the hill. You can't see the green. And Ricky had the tee, and he hit 3 or 5-wood, one of the two. And if he had hit a nice shot, I'd already made up my mind that I was going to go for it also. Well, he hit it left, and I couldn't see it, but I thought it was – I knew it was short-sided. I thought it might be in the heather. So I laid it up to the top of the hill and still had a wedge in. And sure enough, his ball was in the heather, and I picked up a shot. So that was all – that was dependent on him. And, you know, if I had the tee, I'd have probably gone for it there. But anyway.
Playing a little match play.
Yep.
So after you won, how much did your life change pretty much overnight, being a major champion, second tour win?
Yeah, literally overnight. Yeah, my Michelle in management group, she called me and she goes, that flip phone you got? I said, yeah. She goes, that's out. I said, what do you mean? She goes, I have to be able to get a hold of you, and you have to know how to read an email and answer an email on your phone now. I went, oh, bummer. But, no, it was quick. It was you know, I say it all the time. All of a sudden, everybody wanted to know what I thought. Like, all of a sudden, I'm smart. You know, hey, what do you think about this? Like, well, you didn't ask me that 2 weeks ago, and
right.
I hadn't won anything. But, yeah, it changed. I got busy, and I got a lot of offers to go a lot of places and play a lot of cool tournaments, and a lot of them I didn't. I wanted to focus here, and I thought the best chance to do that was have an off season, rest, and get ready to try to improve on it the next season. The most gratifying thing about post that U.S. Open was contending at the PGA, and you know, a decent back nine Sunday, I would have been right there. I finished 5th or 6th, and so that was kind of the
validation
of, all right, I did it, and I competed again, and that was. That was fulfilling, I think, and gratifying. Yeah, good word.
What was the celebration like after you won?
It was great. We straight to the city and Benjamin Steakhouse, actually. So, you know, typical guy meal, bunch of steak and bunch of red wine and Tignanello. That was great. So, yeah, we had a good time.
So when did the beard come into play?
Fall 2010, out of just sheer laziness. I just, you know, two things I hate more than anything, shaving and ironing. One of them I don't do anymore. One of them I do as little as possible shaving. So I just got lazy with it, and somebody went, hey, man, that kind of looks cool. It looks pretty good. I was like, yeah, whatever. They were like, no, I just trim that and leave it. I was like, all right, we'll see. And then let it grow, and next thing you know, there it was. Yeah. It was a thing. And, I enjoyed it. You know, it was, you know, something to talk about in the locker room other than the 7-iron. So it was fun.
So then fast forwarding to 2012, you had an injury, your left knee, right? You heard it. Paddleboarding, is that right?
Right knee, correct. Yep, right knee. Out in Kapalua. I was paddleboarding, and I'd been paddleboarding 4 or 5 times a week for 6-7 months. And I guess Hawaii, when you hire a guide to take you around, you got to wear shoes for their insurance because of the coral. And I was falling off like I'd done 100 times and tried to spin over and fall on my back, and my right shoe caught on the edge of the board, and I heard it pop. So, busted my MCL up pretty good and tore my meniscus. So took a few weeks off and tried to play, and a bad decision. Tried to rehab it, play through it, and just one of those, I don't know the term, competitive bad decisions, that one of those things you, looking back on, you wish just to got it operated on in February and been done with it. Instead, I waited till September and formed some pretty bad habits in my golf swing from trying to play through it and protect it.
That's kind of what I wanted to ask, is that when your living is made through your body, right? Like everything is kind of based on your body. It's got to be so hard, unless you are devastatingly hurt, to really hang it up and just say, I'm not going to play.
Right, right. No, that's exactly right. And it was one of those things, like in practice, it was okay. It was fine. But once I got out walking, the stress on it from walking, trying to continue my workouts, and then the grind we've talked a lot about a few weeks in a row, and it wore down even more, and my golf swing was already suffering, and I was in a transition on a 6-iron on number 5 in Greensboro, and it completely gave out. And you know, again, like you said, hard to stop if you're not unable to walk. I played 5 more holes, just moron. anyway, did that, and that was it. Surgery a month later, and bittersweet, because I got out of surgery, and my wife was the one that was sick, and we found out we were pregnant with the first child when I got out of surgery. So bittersweet surgery, but it was that was cool.
Do you, and your game kind of took a dip during that time period, but you've had a bit of a career resurgence in the last few years. What do you attribute that to?
Putting better.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no secret why I was struggling. You know, I've fought the yips, and no problem talking about it, no problem saying the word. I had it, have it, not a thing, but got a pretty good handle on it. Still get nervous, still get anxious over some short ones, but I've worked hard enough on the mental approach and some physical stuff, and I think my putting stroke's as good as it's ever been.
What is that like to kind of go through that? I mean, everyone kind of battles that at some point, I think.
Yeah, but it's absolutely devastating mentally to hit the ball like I normally hit it and walk up to a green and be nervous, even if it's the first hole on Thursday. And, you know, you hit a nice 7-iron in there 15 feet, roll it by a couple feet and miss it, and it's devastating. Yeah. I just played the hole as it should be played, and because of a mental issue I have, I just made bogey. And I fought it for years, and I still get nervous.
How did you address it, or what did you do to kind of combat it?
Well, I got over-instructed, my fault, too much information, too many people, instead of sticking with one thing. And I'm not blaming any of those instructors. They were all great, had my best interest, gave me a lot of good information, but I took too much information. And I got mentally swamped, and I kind of forgot. I forgot what made me a good putter, albeit a streaky putter. I was a good putter. When it was streaky, it was really good. But I lost sight of that and kind of fell victim to technology, kind of fell victim to equipment, kind of fell victim to wanting information. I'm not a dumb person, but I play better when I don't know much. Anyway, again, I'm not taking anything away from anybody I've ever worked with, but I asked for too much.
Yep.
And all they did was their job.
Right.
But I think that compounded my issue, because all of a sudden what I naturally did well wasn't natural anymore. And I'm just now kind of getting back to that, that natural kind of hands forward, keeping them forward through the ball stroke instead of the neutral stuff that the new putters promote, which is, you know, which is a fine way to putt, obviously. There's tons of people that putt well that way. I'm just not one of them. And I, last year, and I predominantly clawed most of the year, especially from short. And most of this year I've been regular-handed and, you know, been good, not great. You know, there's been some streaks where it was really good and some streaks where it was bad. And statistics say it was bad, but I don't feel like it's been that. Ball striking isn't where it needs to be so far, but we're working on that too.
There you go. All you got to read is the Mark Brody stuff, and you won't feel any pressure
with putting.
We'll get you out of here on this. So I hear you're quite a reader. What do you read these days, or what do you like? What do you typically like to read?
I just started a book called Sapiens, which is like a history of obviously Homo sapiens. But I'm like 6 pages in. Literally started it last night. But I read everything. I've made a pact with myself for every, I call them airport books, for every airport murder mystery, I got to read 2 proper books that I can actually gain some intelligence from. So trying to read this Sapiens just for some insight on, you know, human history basically and how we got here. I think a lot of it's maybe sensationalized because nobody really has an account of, depending on what you believe, 1 million years ago or 10,000 years ago, but it's it drew me in the back of it, so I'm interested. But
what's your number one like book recommendation or the
Pillars of the Earth?
Pillars of the Earth.
Pillars of the Earth, and there's 2 more, World Without End, and the newest one just came out, A Column of Fire. English writer named Ken Follett. English history, religion, love, romance, murder, you name it.
Wow.
Every book has everything. It was recommended to me by a family member, and I finished it, and I just kind of reflected on it, and I said, all right, I've never read anything where I've, like, hit every emotion possible in a book. And that one did it, and then the second one did it, and now the third one's done it. I just finished it. So pretty amazing. So that would be that's my favorite of all time, and that trilogy would be up there for recommendations.
Did you really read 4 books during the U.S. Open?
Yes. That's how much –
downtime.
I was in the hotel. and, you know, I mean, again, those were those airport books I was talking about. Pick them up and put them down, and
there you go.
2-3 hours and you're done with them. But any way to pass the time out here when you're solo in a hotel.
I understand it. So, all right. Thank you so much for your time, man. Sorry to
thank
take
you.
Up so much of it, but thanks for joining, and best of luck this week and down the road as well.
Thanks so much.
Appreciate it.
Be the right club. Be the right club today.
Yes! Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!